Okay. We're all set.
Yeah, there are two things that are very important in this whole bit, and that the first one is that Mary Lee and I got married before we before I graduated from the University of Montana, and I want to say a few words about that. And the other thing that I want to say is that probably related to that is the fact that I spent about 15 months in the service,
yeah,
and in the Coast Guard, and that I was assigned to an attack transport to go to Japan when the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and which suddenly changed my orders to go to Hawaii and replace people that were being released from service very rapidly. In any event, that period perhaps gave me a somewhat different slant on life that I might not have otherwise had. One of them being that having had a relationship with Mary Lee at long distance via letters and so on, we decided that we wanted to get married, that life would be a lot more pleasant if we could live together. And in those days, you did not live together without being legally married. So we were married the summer before my last year in undergraduate work at Montana. And Mary Lee was the secretary of the English department there.
Now, can you spell Mary Lee's name?
Oh, yes.
It's unique.
It's Mayre dash. Well, there's no dash. I put it there to make it used. Lee, L-double-E. The Mary is spelled Mayre because she had two grandmothers at her birth, which occurred at home in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and they were both, of course, present at the happy event. And one's name was May, and the other's name was Mary. And so her mother decided that she would combine the two in order to keep the peace.
Uh-huh.
And so she is, although commonly she's called Mary Lee. Her mother, when she was angry, would call her Mary Lee.
Mary Lee.
And Lee is her father's name.
Uh-huh. When you mention Mary Lee, your young wife at the time, and being your last year for your undergraduate degree, how did that, if at all, have an impact on what it allowed you to do? Or as a student, did it have any impact on being a student going toward thinking about an advanced degree?
The presumption was that I was going to do that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We really had virtually no adjustment to make in our marriage. We had a funny little basement apartment. Actually, it was a kind of a cellar apartment, really, with a Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Ward, I don't know which, tin shower in the coal room.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. Off of our apartment. And but it had a great virtue, and that was that it was $35 a month.
Uh-huh.
and it was very close to the campus.
Uh-huh.
So the life just was a lot more pleasant.
Uh-huh.
Okay. For both of us, and
did she bring in an income at that point, or was she?
Well,
a student?
Yeah, she was secretary of the H. God Merriam's Department of English.
Uh-huh.
at the college.
Uh-huh.
And she had gone to the University of Montana. She had attended the University of Montana for a couple of years, but
before you got married,
before we were married, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, as a result of having been in the service, although I probably didn't deserve it, I had the GI Bill,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had saved because that particular GI Bill, if you were eligible at all, you got 1 year.
Oh,
and then you got additional time related to your time in service.
Ah, okay.
And so I knew how much time I had on the GI Bill. And so I paid, or my family paid mostly, 1 year in college. They didn't know what my thoughts were at the time, I don't think.
Uh-huh.
So that the GI Bill was still working when, mm-hmm. when we got married, and it would not have been. We would have had a year to have to pay.
Ah, I see. But, so it was available to you.
It was available. And it turned out then that we had enough to have more than half a semester, so that when I entered graduate school, I could pay a summer and more than half a semester in the fall, and it would pay till the end of the semester.
Now that you've mentioned, since there is a difference between what graduate students receive if they're a graduate in their graduate assistantships nowadays. I want to come back to that when we get to when you start talking about starting your graduate degree. Let's also talk about things like assistantship and how that existed for you.
Yeah. We were at the point where Professor Broman, mm-hmm. who had been my undergraduate advisor and a very good one,
mm-hmm.
Had given me a list of five men that he thought were the outstanding experimental endocrinologists in the country. Mm-hmm. And I had written to all of them as individuals to ask about working with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one other very, very important thing. Was that he said, write to the people you want to work with. Don't write just generally to the university.
Uh-huh. Okay, so write that directly to the faculty.
Write directly to the faculty member that you want to work with.
Okay.
And one of the things was that I expected, I knew that there existed such things as research assistantships, and I hoped to also get a research assistantship.
So you knew of this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And
how did you know of things like this? Because many students don't. How do you think you had this knowledge or acquired it?
I don't recall how I did. I think they sent me either instructions to apply for graduate. I think each of the places that thought I was eligible to come to be a graduate to enter their graduate school. Mm-hmm. I think they then sent me letters saying to apply. And actually, Dr. Meyer, both the two that I was most interested in,
here at UW-Madison
and Harvard,
and Harvard,
and they both offered me assistantships, research assistantships, and the one in Madison was from the graduate school and a Wharf assistantship.
So the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, that's where the funds were coming from?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they called it because it was different in that it was not money that was from a grant that uh-huh. Dr. Meyer had gotten from the government or other sources. Then he asked me if it would be all right if he withdrew that assistantship and gave me one on a research grant, because his research grant had come through.
Oh, I see.
And uh-huh. and it would allow other people to use the money, and of course it didn't make any difference to me because they were the same amount of money was involved. And so, I was because of what Dr. Broman had said, I was felt that Wisconsin was the better of the two. The choice was better to work with Roland K. Meyer, and he was professor of zoology here, it was a really fine zoology department at the time. I think it still is.
What year was this?
That was, we were married in the summer of 1949, and I graduated in June of 1950, and we drove to Madison in a 39 Ford with a cracked block and everything we owned in a two-door sedan.
In a two-door sedan, okay.
Yeah. That worked very well for that trip and for about 9 months longer before it died.
Now, two things I'm wondering about. Let's start with the. So you knew you had an understanding of Meyer's research and that you wanted to be a part of his lab. What was that in particular, and what drew you here?
He was working with the steroid hormones, okay. and he had made major contributions to the function of the steroid hormone of pregnancy. Progesterone, and I was interested in reproductive physiology, as that's the main thing that he was interested in, and so that was why I came here. I had great luck because he had had a couple of students He had read some old literature that said that if you treated either rats or mice with high levels of estrogen for a long period of time, they would develop pituitary tumors.
Hmm.
And the tumors were, they were not malignant. That is, they did not spread through the body, but they got very big. And they were thought to be, it was thought that they were not secreting hormones at all.
Oh, the tumors.
No. The tumors. But that they just were taking up space and pressing against the octic chiasma, which is the where the well, let's never mind that. Anyway, he decided that he wanted to find out really how come, rationalize why this occurred. And he had a grant, and there were five students at the time who were working on that grant.
Wow.
To come up with get information that would give some feeling of what was really going on, and how, if anything, there was an association with the normal function of estrogen.
Okay.
So, I arrived at the right time because that one student who was doing the keeping a large group of animals on estrogen to supply the program. There were people working on enzymology of the tumors, and the others were doing other things. And
when you say a large group of animals, how many are we talking about?
Oh, probably 50 or so rats.
Okay,
it's not a huge group, as it turns out. I had much bigger groups later on. The fellow that was supposed to be taking care of the animals decided he was going to take the summer off.
Ah,
and he left without really saying anything to anybody. And Meyer said, "I would like you to do this for me." So I immediately was thrown into a responsible position. And it turns out that as time went on, and I was playing with these tumors and so on, the rest of the students got fed up with the problem because it seemed not to be going anyplace, and I wound up with a very good problem.
Now, when this was the summer of
1950.
Of 1950, and you took over.
Oh, it was.
Or was it 51?
I take it back. It was the fall of 1950.
Oh, fall. Okay.
Because we had taken a month off to hike through the Bob Marshall Wilderness area with Joyce and Dick.
With your friends, the Haydens.
Yeah, right.
So you took over the care of the animals. Is that correct, what you're saying?
Yeah, that was the initial thing. Well, and other people withdrew from the thing, so I wound up working with these animals and following the process of tumorigenesis. Just the original thing was to go and take a look at the size over time, and to also look at the pituitary gland had different series of the cells of the anterior pituitary gland, which was the part that proliferated, and the part that secretes ACTH, growth hormone, hormones that control the thyroid gland, and hormones that control the ovaries and the testes, and they via often they do it. They control another group of hormones that goes ahead and does the business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's a master. It's called the master gland, which I don't particularly like. It's the place where there is a connection between the central nervous system and the endocrine system,
mm-hmm.
Where the information is passed back and forth between the two.
I'm sorry, it'll be a speak over you. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, they had long been known that there were cells that took up dyes differently.
Mm-hmm.
There were basophil cell, that's a cell that takes up basic, chemically basic dyes, and acidophils that take up acid dyes, and chromophobes that don't take up either.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, the histology, people were very interested in which group of these cells secrete what hormones. And to make a very long story short, I found out which of the cells gave rise to the tumors.
Mm.
And I found out that the tumors, in fact, were secreted a pituitary hormone, and what pituitary hormone they secreted.
Mm.
And so that they had been thought to be non-secretory.
Mm.
And it should be said that they secreted a hormone called prolactin, which has many functions. But it's called prolactin because it controls lactation.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that the most common source of sterility in young women is prolactinomas, which are the kind of tumors that I was producing in the animals by treating with chronically with estrogen.
With the estrogen.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a good, turned out to be a good student problem.
Mm-hmm. Did so you were also then performing the surgery on the mice as well.
I was doing,
you were
predominantly, all of that work was done in rats.
In rats, okay, in rats.
Yeah. Rats are much better animals for a lot of things, mm-hmm. because they're big enough to do virtually all the surgeries that you can do on an experimental animal. If you can do it on a dog, you can do it on a rat.
Uh-huh.
And it's a lot cheaper.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And in many cases, it works better.
Now, a little bit more about the assistantship. So first they offered, Myers offered the assistantship through Worf, and then when he got his grant came through, he asked you to switch out so that he could, you know, give that to someone else that was still available. What did the assistantship entail? What did it offer you? And what I mean that, not only pay, but also any benefits and services, if anything like that existed, care for you, for your wife?
No, it paid money, and the idea was that you could live on it.
Okay.
And there were a lot of, Meyer had 50, he actually had on paper 30 graduate students.
Wow.
when I was working with him.
Mm-hmm.
But only 15 of them were serious, quotes. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that were in the laboratory, and we had a wonderful group of people in that laboratory, and we ate together. That was, I noticed that.
Wow. Yeah.
Every noon. And Mary Lee was in Bascom Hall, during the first couple of years, and she would come over. The Burge Hall is, as you know, is right close to Bascom.
Right.
And she would come over and have lunch with us every day.
Uh-huh. So she just walked over next door.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. And so it was very nice. And Mary Lee would, I worked out simple ways to get an estimate of whether the thyroid stimulating hormone was increased, decreased, or non-existent, and other things. So I did a lot of surgery, and she would come often and read to me while I was doing surgery, or while I was doing autopsies of the animals to find out what the had happened with them.
What an example? What I'm assuming this is after her hours of work. What are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about evenings. Uh-huh. And she'd come and work and she also I minored in biochemistry and worked on a series of enzymes that I thought might be changed with the treatment, and so that I was doing some biochemistry stuff in the lab, and she would come in sometimes and wash dishes for when I had to wash dishes and stuff like that.
Now to complete the picture, so your wife was working in Bascom. Who was she working for? What was she doing?
Oh, she was working in the office of A.W. Peterson, who was the vice president of business and finance of the university. That's not in the school of business. It didn't exist to any great extent at that point, I don't think.
Okay.
This was his role was the handling the monetary business of the university, and he shared his office with Clark Smith, and Mr. Smith was the secretary of the Board of Regents, and she was a stenographer who they had one woman who ran the immediate control of the office, and she was great, and then Mary Lee was one of, I think, two stenographers who didn't, and that was during the days of typing with a big typewriter, and when she typed the minutes of the Board of Regents, she had to type something like 5 or 7 carbon papers. She could really whack a typewriter key
to get through all that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyway.
So you had both your, and I don't know what the income levels would be for a graduate assistantship, and then a stenographer secretary, and were you living near campus? What was your situation?
That is another whole set.
Okay.
Whole line that was amazing. I learned that after the decision had been made to come to Wisconsin, I learned from my mother, who said she had kept it quiet because she didn't want to influence my decision, that we had relatives in Madison, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
And one pair in particular she had known pretty well was a woman about her age who was in the Dean of Women's office, the equivalent or equivalent of that, at the university, and we got orders because the family wanted to make sure that the car held together long enough to get us to where we were coming. They required that we call back to Spokane and while we were on the road. It took about 3 days to get here. And so we did, and we got orders to call this family when we arrived. And the orders were to call them before we did anything else. That just when we arrived in town, we were to call the Grabers.
The Grabers.
Okay. Yeah. And I didn't know anything about, had never met these people.
Okay.
But when we did call them, they said, "We want to see you tonight, this evening." And we called about 5 o'clock or so in the afternoon, or 6 o'clock. And when and they gave us orders to come to their house and told us where it was, and we found it. And when we arrived, we met Lawrence Graber, who turned out was chairman of agronomy.
He was the chair at the time.
Yeah.
Of agronomy. Okay.
Yeah. And a very well-known professor on campus. And his wife was the relative. She was my mother's first cousin.
Okay.
And she was all dolled up to go out to dinner with him. And what they knew, they both knew, was that housing was extremely short on campus.
Was this the GI boom?
It was the GI boom still. And there were people that Camp Randall was covered with trailer houses and Quonset huts, and Midvale was still part of the Hill Farm. It was a functional university farm. And part of that, on the east side of Midvale Boulevard, there was a big area that had been a plowed field, and it was now covered with trailer houses and Quonset huts on wooden floors, and with wooden sidewalks through the place, because a plowed field is all mud when it rains.
Was this across the street from what would now be Hildale?
Right across the street from Hildale.
Correctly across the street, corner of Midvale and University Avenue.
Yeah, and it was a big area.
Okay.
And the Badger Ordnance Works, which is, as you know, is on the road to Sauk City, housing, they had strip housing there, and that was all used for students' housing, and they went by buses. The students that lived there went by bus every day back and forth, and we were signed up for a student housing there.
Near the Badger Ordnance.
Near Badger, right across the highway from Badger Ordnance.
And I think that's Highway 12.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. And that, we just happened to pass that on the way to Madison.
Oh, you did.
And we stopped and went to the office and said, told them who we were. And asked them where we would be living. And they said, "Sure, we'll show it to you." And they just told us where it was and gave us the key. And we went and looked at this place, and somebody had torn the sink off the wall.
Oh no!
And somebody, maybe the same person, had started out with leftover wallpaper of different designs, and as they moved across the wall, they'd shift to the next leftover wallpaper to the next one. It was a mess. It was just awful.
So you saw this first.
And Mary Lee broke into tears looking at this thing. And so we thought that we could, if we could locate a place in town, that we could, if you added up, because we did not have children, and we were not planning on having children during my graduate studies, that she would be working, and it would be, if you added the cost of shipping the two of us back and forth on the on a bus, to the cost of the housing there, it worked out that you could pay significantly a significant amount for the an apartment. So that's what we had planned to do, was to seek an apartment in town. And when we arrived at the Grabers, they said, "We want you, it would do us a great favor if you would come and live with us for the summer," because Professor Graber had to go spend a lot of time out west with where the seed for seeds for alfalfa that he was working with.
That was his research.
That was his research area. And he had to spend a lot of time going back and forth, and he traveled on other business for related to the university and the department. And Frankie, his wife, had a stroke, and he didn't want her to be alone while he was gone.
How old were the Grabers at the time?
I have no idea. I would guess 60, right close to 60. And Frankie said, "And I'll guarantee that I can get you a very good department, or apartment.
Apartment.
If you'll come and stay there, there'll be a place that I know a lot of people that." And so we did.
Now, am I correct that you said that Frankie worked for the university as well?
Yeah, she had before they were married.
Right, and she worked as a, connected to the dean of women's.
Yeah, when the comparable. I don't know that they called it the dean of women. She worked with women students.
Okay, and Frankie Graber.
Yeah, but her. When she was working for the university, she was Frankie Trainer.
Trainer. Okay.
Before she was married.
Okay.
And in fact, that's one of the reasons that they were not married until they were married rather late in their life, and had no children of their own. But they essentially they raised one young woman who was a relative and contributed to raising three young men. Two of whom we knew that one of them was still in school here, and another one had just graduated.
Okay.
Anyway, they found us an apartment which was behind the Congregational Church on Breeze Terrace. At the corner of Breeze Terrace and University.
Right over there. On Lathrop.
On Lathrop. And we were in the second house up. It's now the first house because the first house has been torn down. But it was the second house up Lathrop Hill up from University Avenue.
So the corner of Lathrop and Kendall?
No, the corner of the corner of Lathrop and University Avenue.
Oh yes.
And it's the second house up Lathrop. Gotcha. From University Avenue.
Right.
And there was the first house has been torn down and is a parking area for the Mormon Church, I think. Or what was at that time the Mormon Church, the Mormon Church had not been built, but it became the Mormon Church, and now it's a genealogy thing for the Mormons, a genealogy library, I think.
Okay.
At the end of the summer, we moved into that apartment, which was very nice. It was not an apartment, really. It was a bunch of rooms off of a hallway. There was a real apartment, one more floor up, that they'd finished off the attic. So that was an apartment in that it had things laid out without going into a hallway. Mm-hmm. But they had to come through our hallway to get to their apartment. And it was the people that owned the place was a retired Methodist minister, and his wife had been the dean of the school what did they call home
economics?
Economics. Uh-huh. Her name was Nellie Kedzie Jones, and they were both in their 90s.
Mm. Mm.
But you'd never know it.
Mm.
And he loved to sing, and he had an old Philco radio that went like this. Mm-hmm. And he would sit like he was watching a TV set, but it wasn't. It was the radio, and sing with him. And one time I heard him singing, Blatz is Milwaukee's favorite beer. And he was a teetotaler. Anyway, and we had one telephone, and the way that was worked out was that there was a little silver bell that was on a string that hung on the stairway railing.
Uh-huh.
And ran down to the telephone, which was down on the first floor, and they go ding, ding, ding.
If it was for you?
If it was for us. Uh-huh. And we would run down to take it. But it was a neat place to live.
How long were the two of you there and then?
Well, yeah. We were there for a year. And then Frankie died. And not long after her death, Larry called and said, would you please come back and live with me? I want to keep the house, and I would like it very much. So we said, we'll do it only if we do it on a business basis. That we'll pay you, when we were first there, we'll pay you what we figure we pay for our food, plus the rent. And Larry said that would be fine. So that's what we did, and he still had his old cook that had lived with him, lived there, and cooked for the two of them.
Where is there?
In Nakoma,
mm-hmm.
on Wabin Hill.
So you were graduate students living with Lawrence Graver in Nakoma, Wabin Hill. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Larry said, you can have people in if you want, you know. And so we had, a couple of times we had parties at the house. And he said, you know, I won't interfere with anything, but he loved him. he would stay downstairs and talk to them before. Normally he disappeared after dinner and went and read in bed. Uh-huh. And he'd done that even when they were married, and he'd got up then at 5:30 or so, and in the morning, so that he worked was a very hardworking man.
So he was still on the faculty. I mean, he was the chair of the department, still active on the faculty.
Still very active. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's where I was indoctrinated with the Wisconsin idea. And the wonderful stories of how Larry got started, and he was a farm boy, the third or fourth son. It was the youngest son of a cattle trader in the Mineral Point area.
Mineral Point, Wisconsin.
Yeah, and he was assigned by the university after he took his master's degree. He was assigned by the university to go and bring to the farmers the results of improved farming that developed it by the university. And the thing that he was told to do was to go show them the effects of spreading lime on the land, because the soil was acid, and it would increase their yield significantly. And when he went down there, and I may have told you this story before.
Please tell me it.
He was having very little luck getting the farmers to pay any attention to him. That Graeber kid goes off to college, and now he thinks he can tell us how to run our farms. What's he know that's worth knowing? And what do they do at the university all this stuff? And so one of his brothers had land that could be seen from two or three of the county roads, highways, a hillside. And in the spring, he went up on the hillside and he put his initials in large letters of lime on that hillside. And then he waited. And in August, when everything was brown, why, Larry Graeber's initials, Lawrence F. Graeber's initials, LFG, was green. And he converted the whole county.
Now, was there a certain, we've talked about alfalfa, was that what he was at that time?
That's ultimately what he was, yeah. And that was that's an interesting thing, that most of the hay was and still in some places still is for other reasons made up of grass, of different kinds of grass, but grass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And grasses are very shallow. And in Wisconsin, because it has very good soil, they could plan on getting two crops of grass hay, or maybe even three in a very good year.
Uh-huh.
But alfalfa is a legume. Mm-hmm. And it's not as hard on the land because it fixes nitrogen, and it has deeper roots, and it has many advantages. And one of them is that you get anywhere from 3 to 5 rather than possibly 2 to 3 yields off of it. Mm-hmm. And it has nutritional value that's higher than the grasses. So that, but the problem is that you couldn't grow it in the north. It's not, it would not sustain itself in the in this
here in Wisconsin.
Of, yeah, here in Wisconsin, and so they got the idea that they could develop groups of seed, select seeds mm-hmm. that would grow here. Mm-hmm. But not reproduce. They couldn't reproduce.
Oh, okay.
So they had to be the seed had to be produced in Arizona Nevada, someplace, or mm-hmm. or California mm-hmm. in the West mm-hmm. and brought north, and that's what he did, and they selected seeds that would do this, mm-hmm. and then actually they converted people to alfalfa. And but the hitch is that you can get the seeds from the donor plants in warm areas, mm-hmm. but the plants are much more complex than corn in their genetics. You can't with corn. They only have 11 pairs of chromosomes in corn. Which is really a very small number. Mm-hmm. And with alfalfa. It's I don't know how many chromosomes it's got, but it's a big number, and you can't select out strains that. So the best you can get is a mixture of genes that will grow in the northern climate. But you have to constantly be developing new mm-hmm. Seed mm-hmm. stock. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think vernal alfalfa was the first one that worked, and mm-hmm. they had names then like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was called Mr. Alfalfa, is that he changed agriculture in all of the northern states across the United States.
Now, and the alfalfa, the purpose of the alfalfa, was that for dairy or was that for human?
It's for any kind of stock.
That
grazes.
Truly for.
So okay. that beef or dairy.
So but this was
in,
replacing
in Wisconsin,
the wheat.
It was not wheat. Wheat is too expensive. It was replacing such grasses as timothy.
That's okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So now the reason why I'm focusing on this is because you had mentioned before that Lawrence Graeber was part of your indoctrination to the Wisconsin idea.
Right.
And I wanted to get a background on how he was expressing, enacting the Wisconsin idea through his work and what you've just talked about alfalfa. Can you tell me more what that means to you when you say you were indoctrinated into the Wisconsin idea, and first of all, what that is to you, and then what the impact was upon you?
Well, made me aware of how important the university can be to the state as a source of information, as a source of new ideas throughout the state. And Wisconsin was one of the major universities to really make an effort to to do this, which now most of the state, the agriculture schools do that. And in fact, the Wisconsin has done it not only through the School of Agriculture, it also had a series of courses that were ran through the long winters out in the boondocks. I thought that was a wholly desirable kind of thing to be doing. I think the whole setup of WARF works on behalf of the university to better the state of Wisconsin, and I think that is a terribly important thing, even though I love the whole idea of the researcher doing very esoteric things in poetry or something, all the way to the person who brings in alfalfa. That they're all making contribution also to the state. And then beyond, with Wisconsin, beyond the state, very early, Wisconsin had large numbers of relatively speaking, of Indians, that is, Indians, who came here to study.
So international students.
International students, yeah. And that was a time when there were very few international students at most universities, and it was just very important. He went out and talked to people all over the state about the university and about things that were done and being done in the university. He did such things also. There was a problem with seed quality for not just alfalfa, but corn is much bigger. I shouldn't say much bigger, but it was a problem with the quality of seeds and the level of contamination of seeds, crop seeds with weeds seeds. The problem was made difficult for the farmers because you had to plant the seeds before you found out that you had lousy seeds.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And so Larry said, well, we can contribute to that. And so he made deals with some of the local seed companies to take a random samples of their seed and grow it under controlled circumstances and tell you what fraction of the seeds there were, weed seeds and et cetera. And then he would make a deal to put a paper on the bags of seeds saying that this was done by the University of Wisconsin, and this is the quality of the seeds. And that led to all kinds of trouble for him. He had people calling him up saying that they were going to see that he got fired from the university. They were wrecking their business.
Competing with the private industry.
He was telling people how good their seed was.
Ah.
And if the seed was lousy, that's what he said.
Quality control. Yeah, he was actually establishing quality control.
That's what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
And so he had some people that mm-hmm. he knew in the seed industry that were just delighted with it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who were good people, to be good seed producers and
mm-hmm.
and so on, and then there were others who were selling lousy stuff, and they're the ones that were calling him up and raising hell with him about ruining his business. So it became finally then a self paid for itself to do it. The people ultimately settled down and said that they'd pay him to check these samples out, and it got to the point where people wouldn't buy unless the tag was on it saying that it was good.
Wow.
And he knew it was successful when people were counterfeiting.
the tags.
The tags.
Wow. So this is one example of the Wisconsin idea.
That's one example of the Wisconsin idea. One of the best that I know. It's a straightforward mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm. Mm.
And he also wrote books in agronomy for students that came here.
Okay. Yeah. There's one story. His approach. I'd be curious to hear you tell about how would he, outside of showing like he did with his initials on the hillside for folks in the greater Mineral Point area, showing that indeed it works with lime, but how he approached folks who may not have known him or what he might have represented from, who is this college-educated guy coming out in my farm to tell me whatnot, how he approached people. I don't know if you know.
Mary Lee likes this story. One of the evenings she was, we were with him, and he said, he was a good speaker. He looked a lot like, he had a shock of, by then, absolutely white hair. And there was a senator from Illinois that was a great orator, and he looked somewhat like that senator, mostly with the white hair and all about the same size, I think. And he would say, "Wisconsin has no Mesabi Iron Range. It has no Detroit car works. It just has its hard working people," and everybody clap for themselves. and that's one of the ways he got started. Yeah. And that worked. And people loved him. He would he once received a letter to Mr. Alfalfa, USA.
Wow. It got to him.
And it got to him.
It was addressed that way only.
Addressed that way only. And it was from Europe.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Okay. I could tell you another story that I'm not sure it would be.
Please. I don't. If you cannot edit yourself, please don't edit yourself.
Okay. He was talking about his father, who was not an educated man, but who was very smart. And in fact, Larry and he made a fair amount of money by buying cattle in the Midwest that were thought to be too big for to be used for beef, too old. And it was true that the Jewish population on the East Coast liked larger, that their beef cuts were preferentially from large animals.
Huh.
And so when there was a beef shortage, I can't remember when this was. It may have been in the early Depression or in the 20s. There was a beef shortage, and they bought these big cattle and took them to Boston.
Wow.
And sold them and made a real killing on that one year. And his father, he said, the greatest and most sincere statement about his father was by one of the cattle traders that said, that Louis Graber, he can look further up a cow's ass than anybody.
That was a high compliment, huh?
That's a high compliment.
Now I have to include this. I have to one story that I had always received about Lawrence Graber was that when he would connect to a farmer, it isn't that he would start talking about whatever it was, the alfalfa or about particular strain type of seed, corn. Rather, the conversation would start off with sports and how the Badger football team was doing. And that there was a link established first through the knowledge of pride for the athletics of these are our state Badgers.
Yeah.
And then once you warmed up, like what he was saying about we don't have the Mesabi, we don't have the car industry, we've got just good solid hardworking folks. That was his in for the other conversations warming up.
Yes, that was a common one, and he felt that it was very important to have. the Badgers and have them playing football, particularly the football was the most important. Also boxing
as well.
Yeah, and boxing went on until
the 60s, I think.
Yeah, it was because we used to go to the boxing matches, and partly because Idaho State University, Idaho State College actually it was at that time, and Gonzaga were two of the last hangers-on with Wisconsin. Michigan State, and I can't remember any of the others. There were others. There were quite a large number of colleges that had boxing. But they dropped it ultimately because there was a young man who was killed, I think.
Right.
And they stopped it, and that happened while we were in Boston after we left here. And we had but they had two very Very good boxers. One of them was in the heavyweight area. Oh, Iowa used to be.
Iowa as well.
Had boxers. This fellow, he was rather well known around Madison. And I can't remember his name now, but he was built like a heavyweight in the upper body. But he was very slender down and lower, and the result was, and he was just quick as lightning, very, very fast. And most of the heavyweights were big, heavy guys, and he'd hit them five times for every once they hit him. And he hit like a mule. And finally, it was so common that he knocked him down and occasionally knocked him out, even with all the gear.
Mm-hmm.
And that the other coaches wouldn't put their heavyweights in the same ring with him.
Wow.
They'd concede the fight.
Wow. Wow.
But I saw him fight, and it was a really incredible. He was very, very fast.
So this was a link. So football and boxing was an entree to conversations.
Yeah, yeah, and to a lesser extent, other sports.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When I was a student, they had dropped hockey when the war came. For one of the ones that they couldn't handle, and they didn't take it up until the early 60s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again,
I'm going to stop this just for a sec. Dad, I'm sorry. You're going to have to start over this part. I just realized that I had that on pause.
Oh.
And so it was really going back to, I'm so sorry, back to when you're talking about that he had gotten his master's and start back from there.
Yeah. Well, he was on the faculty and everything was just fine as far as his career was concerned here. But he felt that it was important that he have, and that the faculty have, doctor's degrees.
Ah.
And so he took a leave of absence for a couple of years, I think, and went to. Another university, I cannot tell you which one it is. But he got his PhD. And that was looked upon with great favor by a lot of people, and there were other people on the faculty who were madder than heck at him for doing that. Because they thought that it was putting on airs that kind
what
of
taking
thing.
Himself too far away from
if everybody had to have degrees and they didn't, then that they felt that was
degree inflation for the requirements of the work or
yes
okay.
yeah
okay
yeah. Well, because they were doing what they thought was okay without it.
Without it, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they didn't. They thought that he would, that it was a move to lord it over them.
Ah, okay.
I think that's the real reasoning. But it was part of the development of the College of Agriculture that was very important.
Uh-huh. A transition.
Yeah, right.
So, moving in with Lawrence Graber while working on your master's.
Yeah.
And you know, the how just
Now, I should say something about that. Most of the people that worked with R.K. Meyer did not get master's degrees.
Oh, they didn't?
They went directly to PhDs.
Ah.
And I probably would have done that. But I was called in after we had been here for a while to Dr. Meyer's office, and he said, the National Cancer Institute has has a fellowship program. That's a thing you got to compete for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to do that. But it's something you better think about before you say you will. And that is, they give you more money if you have your master's degree.
Uh-huh.
So, I want you to get your master's degree by next spring.
Let me just ask this question. Was it just Meyer's lab, or was it just, or was it common where most folks, when they started a graduate degree, would really be starting and working toward a PhD without the master's, or not doing a master's first and then the PhD? You were really on track for the PhD.
And that was certainly common. Most of the Meyer students did that.
Okay.
I think that many of the ones that had a heavy emphasis on lab work, uh-huh. And it was the beginning of the federal grant system was growing and getting straightened out at that time.
Okay.
And I think it was probably common to most of the labs I would have gone to if I'd gone to any of the others that I applied to.
So you would have immediately been working toward your PhD.
Yeah.
Entering the lab.
Yeah. The additional funding was an important thing.
Uh-huh.
And it also, if you were married, there was another supplement.
If you and had your master's, you mean?
And if that and that one was not dependent on whether or not you had income by being married, other income by as we did,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But just if you were legally married, you got $60 more a month.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And that's that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Now, the assistantships were between $900 and $1,100 a year.
Okay.
12 months.
Aha. Uh-huh. 12 months.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's not a month. That's a 12 month.
right, 12 month.
Yeah.
Right, $900.
Yeah.
To 1,200.
No, it should be said that you could survive uh-huh. on that, and a lot of guys did. I mean, most of them of them did. Having the GI Bill for the first part of it, I had a false semester.
Uh-huh.
That was a nice help.
Right.
And then I had the assistantship, and your mother had the job in the Mr. Peterson's office, and so we weren't. And then we were living with Larry when we when after Frankie died, we were back with Larry, and when his cook died, the only thing we did was buy food. So we had top beef around for when he was in town, which was about half the time.
So
and the rest of the time, we the other half of the time we were eating hot dogs.
So when the, you had and a cook.
Well, the cook, initially we did, for a brief period,
and then the cook died as well.
The cook died, and so Mary Lee, she was fortunate. She had a vacation, and she died on vacation. So we were not in. Wasn't in the house.
So I understand. You paid your own. The assistantship did not cover tuition.
The assistantship
was a paycheck only.
No, it along with the assistantship, did not have to pay out of state tuition.
Okay, so you paid in state tuition.
In state tuition. That's,
and did they cover your health care?
No. Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
Did you have student health care?
We had student health care.
And did it cover your spouse as well?
No.
Was an out-of-pocket expense for you?
You didn't get sick.
Well, but that would have been, in other words, if something had come up.
I don't know. You see, if there was any, I'm not sure that they had, that they covered it for the staff. Uh-huh. But she was staff, and so she would have gotten anything the staff. But as far as I know, we didn't. I can't really tell you too much about it because we were.
It wasn't a need.
Yeah, there wasn't a need.
Okay.
And I don't know of anybody that did have. It was a really wonderful group of students that we worked with, very strongly affected by the fact that about half of them were veterans that were real veterans, not of my stripe of veteran that came late and went home early. It was guys that had been in the war, in fact, I think that it was probably more than half, and so they were. And a lot of them had been flyboys and with all that kind of stuff. We had we helped each other. We also helped. There was another person that you were also really a student of, who was a chemist who worked with Meyer and was a faculty member. And the two of them worked together, but his appointment was in the zoo department.
Who was he?
McShann was his name.
McShann.
Uh-huh. He was a real good man, and he was working on part of his work was on hormone isolation, and we got rats from the local rat breeders. This was the, should be said, Madison was the home of breeding rats for experimental use under real circumstances, good circumstances with good, clean facilities and so on. And that was a by a two fellows, Sprigg and Dolly, Sprigg Dolly. And they started supplying companies that that were in the drug development and business. And Meyer had been, he had taken his PhD here. He had grown up in a little town south of here, southwest, a little bit west, where there was a college. His father was a florist who grew flowers. And I think he was a German immigrant, maybe, or a first-generation American. And Meyer went to the little college, and Milton is the Milton College. And he graduated from there, and then came here to the university and got his PhD in Zoe, working with Heisa, who was then stolen by Harvard, and he replaced Heisa on the faculty here. But he, before he did that, he had worked for a couple of years at Upjohn in Michigan, and he was one of their advisors, consultants, and he took the consultant fees and gave them to the university to support his students.
Wow. So that was giving back. So all consulting work went back into the pool for the students.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that we were a location for the production of clean rats for research.
Yeah.
Was that the university, or was that a private?
That was a private institution, and it became very famous because it was the first, very well known, I shouldn't say very famous. It was the first such group and or such place, and you got a standard, pretty much standardized animal. It was way before that you had germ-free facilities or had inbred groups of animals. So this was before that.
Okay.
It was selected in the sense that they like to have them be docile. They liked them to be within a certain range of weights. And so it was very important. It was a major contribution of Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, to the science of endocrinology and everything else.
Now, and these rats were sent throughout the United States?
They were sent all over the world.
All over the world.
Yeah.
I didn't know about this.
Very few people knew. And they didn't like to have any, much of any, initially, they didn't like to have much of any discussions. The people that owned Sprigg Dolly, they didn't want people to think of them as rat breeders, because they worried what the public would say about rats.
In general,
and they fear this. And there were people that thought they shouldn't be doing this.
It wasn't like PETA in the sense of
like
experimental
PETA.
It's
those crazy people over there. They're increasing the number of rats in my barns. That's the.
Okay. Interesting. So now back to you. So Myers wanted you to get your master's in a short period of time so that you could get fellowship funding.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And so did the master's entail writing a thesis, or was this?
Yeah. And it was I can't even remember the title of it, to tell you the truth. But it was accepted. And,
yeah.
And so my application could include the master's that I got in the first year. And so then the fellowship was for 3 years. And so the first year was, we've gone over, and the 3 years we went over, or was covered by the fellowship. And then Dr. Meyer usually had a graduate student that he'd had around for a while as a special assistant to do things for him. And I took notes in his lectures that he saw my outline system, and he liked the notes. And so he was going to hire all the notes typed up and from his lectures. His lectures were easy to write in outline form, the notes were, and that's what I did. And but he never got them typed up before I left.
Oh no.
which I was sorry about, because they were a good set of notes.
So but at least he had them, you know, in written form.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, but we were never, Meyer was not a close, not a person that people that you got, the students got very close to. There were I think just one, maybe two people that were very close to, who were graduate students. But I think they were both early graduate students of his. And one of them was a fellow, they both went and worked with Upjohn.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. But one of them would get sick every time somebody took prelims. And it was, he just fearful. Now the guy had, by the time I knew him, he had six papers in print. And but he just couldn't, bring himself to. And and everybody, if you were smart at all, you turned to him to answer your questions. Very bright guy. And his wife almost left him. In fact, she did for a while.
This was a true phobia of his.
Yeah, it was a real phobia. And he'd get sick to his stomach if a friend was taking the prelims.
Wow.
So, and finals. And so, while we were here, Dr. Meyer had a dinner at his house, and he invited a group of his of other faculty members to dinner, and Bill was his fellow's name, Bill Burns, and they were a group, and they sat around and talked before and after dinner. And then they said to Bill, please go out and stay in the kitchen for a while. And when they called him back in, they shook his hand and said, you passed with flying colors.
Passed your prelims.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he went to, he finished his degree, and because by his the papers were accepted as chapters.
Oh, well, you
probably wrote an introduction and a summary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And bound the papers because they'd already been through the mill.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was proven.
He was proven. And so it was a very rational and very kind thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he went off to Upjohn and became just below vice president in Upjohn. And the other guy had left here. I didn't know him. I didn't meet him, but he was a vice president. And then one that was one of my group, Jake Stuckey, he got his degree and he worked for somebody else or another drug company, but then he went to Upjohn and he became, I think he was a vice president.
Now, this definitely was the network because of Meyer's connection to Upjohn, too, that indeed he was kind of a pipeline, it sounds like.
Yeah. That, about half of the students of the serious students,
mm-hmm.
the ones that
mm-hmm.
were in the lab all the time.
Right. The 15 of the 30.
Yeah, the 15 of the 30. About half of them went into, and said from the beginning that they were going to go into commercial research.
Mm.
I did not want to do that at all.
Mm.
That's another story, but I was asked to come and interview for a job in SmithKline & French at one time, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to. I was aiming to be a professor.